Welcome to the Red Letter Christians podcast. Red Letter Christians gets our name from the Bibles that highlight the words of Jesus in red. And we're aspiring to live as if Jesus meant the stuff he said. We know that the loudest, most prominent voices representing Christianity in America haven't always been the most beautiful or the most faithful voices. And we know that the way we change the narrative is by changing the narrators. We are committed to amplifying the voices of people who are dedicated to Jesus and to justice.
How much longer will justice be when a law is...
Welcome to Book Club. If this is your first time, you're very welcome. If this is your regular every month, obviously we always love seeing you. I will tell you a few things and then I'm quickly going to get out of the way because I'm excited about the conversation. So first of all, you might notice behind me, I've got one of the wonderful Christ in the Rubble icons by Kelly Lattimore. Most of you, like 1,200 of you donated to Relief in Gaza, and you will be getting one of these if you haven't gotten it already. So we raised over $130,000 for relief that's all going to Gaza. We'll be releasing all of the groups that that's going to. We're excited, but we wanted to make sure that we have everybody kind of all the information. So if people want to keep giving, you can. And we have the original one, by the way. That's not it. It's in an undisclosed location. But anyway, so we got that going. This month, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. You're here tonight, so I know that you're excited about this. If you don't have your book, get it handy. If you haven't done your homework, we always say you're still very welcome. And Divya is going to do a great introduction if you're new to Cole's work, but this is the book we're talking about. And of course, her first book, New York Times bestseller, This Here Flesh. So it's a great month. It's been Black History Month. We've done all kinds of stuff, but we're not confining Black history to February. We celebrate it all the time. Black history is U.S. history and world history, but it is a great month to do this book. There's so many great prayers in here, Cole. I even found some that resonate when I'm 3 o'clock in the morning, like holding my wild, cantankerous child at times. So, but it's amazing. Great book. So next month, our book for Book Club will be Nice Church Patriarchy. And that our very own Susan Wood, who runs our blog and website, will be hosting that. She's going to host the conversation. It's also, I think it's Women's History, which we also don't confine to a month, but we will certainly recognize it in a special way. And so, you know, let's talk patriarchy next month. Susan Wood will host that conversation. It'll be on March 25th. All that stuff will be on our socials. Every month, we do morning prayer. My friend Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove and I host morning prayer from Common Prayer. And if you're new to prayer, if you're kind of not sure how to pray, you're very welcome to join us. It's March 1st. It's like 2 days, I think. And it's at 9 o'clock in the morning. We will be joined by a bunch of our friends in the United Kingdom. There's a really beautiful grassroots movement of Red Letter Christians in the UK, and they just put out a book, Jesus and Justice, with like 30 or 40 different authors. So we're going to hear especially from a lot of the women and celebrate the work of folks, you know, on the ground. There's pastors, activists, school teachers, gardeners, and their amazing stories. So March 1st, 9 a.m. Finally, I think a lot of us have very heavy hearts for the continued violence in Gaza and increasingly in the West Bank, the starvation of children there. We're doing everything that we know to do to support our friends. And many of them are actual close friends of ours that are working to try to end the violence. So we're pushing for a ceasefire, but a permanent ceasefire and a free Palestine. And so we're doing pilgrimages. Our buddy Jared over in the UK started organizing with Lisa Sharon Harper. And now check this out. There are 125 cities around the world in at least 17 countries. It's probably more now that are walking the length of Gaza. So about 23 miles, we're going to walk together. And we, Lisa Sharon Harper and I, are organizing one in Philly. You can organize one in a city where you are, but we're doing Philly. We're marching from the cracked Liberty Bell. Hallelujah. There's a sermon there, Cole. The cracked Liberty Bell all the way to Lockheed Lockheed Martin, which is one of the biggest war profiteers in the world. The bombs and the airplanes that are dropping the bombs in Gaza are made right here outside of Philadelphia. So for Holy Week, starting Palm Sunday, this is a lightweight walk. So we're only doing like 4 miles a day. And if you can't walk it, you can come in solidarity in other ways. But we're going to walk that 20 miles to Lockheed Martin. And on Good Friday, we're asking everybody to show up at the headquarters of Lockheed Martin, where we will participate in a direct action that I cannot talk more about because this is an officially sponsored Red Letter Christian event. But please join us on Good Friday. All the information will be on our website. And tonight is going to be beautiful. So I'll let Divya, I'm going to pass it to Divya so she can welcome co-Arthur Riley, Black Liturgies. This thing is everywhere. It's resonating. Your prayers, your poems, your art is really, I think, connecting with the souls and the streets of so many of us and things happening in the world. So I'll just say, as I move out of the way, thank you, Cole, for your work. Divya.
All right, let's do this. Oh, well, while I affirm the dignity of all frogs, it's just a bit of a shame that I sound like one. But welcome, Cole. It's just such an honor to be able to speak with you today. And before I take a deep dive into Black liturgies, prayers, poems, and meditations for staying human, Cole, with your permission, I'd like to read a little bit about your profile.
Sure.
Cole Arthur Riley is a writer and a poet. She is the New York Times best-selling author of This Year Flesh and Black Liturgies. Her writing has been featured in The Atlantic, Guernica, The Boston Globe, and The Washington Post. Cole is also the creator of Black Liturgies, a space that integrates spiritual practice with Black emotion, Black literature, and the Black body, and a project at the Center of Dignity and Contemplation, where she serves as curator. Born and for the most part raised in Pittsburgh, Cole studied writing at the University of Pittsburgh. She once took a professor's advice very seriously to begin writing a little every day and has followed it ever since for nearly a decade, or I'm guessing more now. So Cole, it seems like you've always known that writing was going to be your calling.
I would say so. I mean, maybe not in the exact way. I don't think I had an imagination necessarily for what has happened, but I've always written, and I've always been most honest in writing. I was a very quiet kid, and my family says I wrote more than I talk, than I spoke, and so something has been there since I was little.
Yeah, I mean, because when I was deciding on a college major, I can tell you I had no idea that it was going to be, you know, like you seem to have known that, okay, I'm going to study writing at the University of Pittsburgh.
Well, I'll complicate that a bit by saying I started as a physics major.
Oh, really? Okay.
And I didn't actually switch. I switched so late. I was 3 years in, I switched to writing. But all along, I had been taking a lot of, you know, extra classes in our English department. But yeah, I tried to resist it.
Yeah, yeah. But you've been writing a long time, right? Like right from the time you were a kid. I mean, that's what you said in This Year Flesh. You've been writing for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about where your journey began.
Well, it begins with a very, very quiet girl. I had something called selective mutism, which is it's an anxiety disorder where you feel unable to speak in certain settings. And for me, that looked like any place that wasn't, you know, around anyone that wasn't my immediate family. I really struggled. And even once I began to express myself verbally more, I still was a very shy child for most of my life through high school. And but when I was little, I would write a lot and, you know, journal every day. My father was really big. I mean, he's not a writer, but I think he knew that I needed something to kind of help me connect with the world around me. And so he encouraged us to journal. He would have us write poems and little stories to get out of chores or to get money or, you know, in order for us to go to our, you know, a friend's house. I didn't have a lot of friends, so mine was mostly to get out of chores, you know, it was write a poem on the color yellow or so he was, I think, from a very young age, drawing me into that kind of creative dimension of my life and of expression.
Mm-hmm. Right. Poetry as payment. That's first.
Yeah, I don't know how all of my anti-capitalist, you know, comrades would feel about that, but poetry as currency, but I think words were a kind of currency in my house, and some of that functioned in beautiful ways.
Yeah, I mean, look at you now. Tell me, you talk a lot about your father, and you also talk a lot about your grandmother. But who were the people in your creative journey, both within your lived experience and also who were the literary and spiritual folks who kind of informed the person you are today and the kind of work that you're now doing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had a kind of dual awakening in college. It was the first time I began to kind of seriously attend a church and found myself. I had gone here and there growing up. My family's not particularly religious. I didn't, read the Bible or pray or talk about Jesus or things like that. And so I first began to kind of consistently attend church in college and was having a kind of awakening. I was learning things for the first time and kind of learning theology for the first time. And simultaneously, I was in college, which is so foreign and different from my family, and learning things in the classroom, specifically concerning Black literature and the Black novel. And all of that was new to me. I'd never read Toni Morrison before college. I didn't know who James Baldwin was. I knew who Alice Walker was. I'd never been assigned to read her. So it was the first time I was encountering kind of the Black novel and Black literary voices. And I just had a hard time compartmentalizing those awakenings. It was very difficult to kind of separate the newness of like the church pew with what was happening in the classroom. So for me, it's very tangled into each other, my kind of the people I look to in a literary sense and in a spiritual sense are in some ways one and the same. I found myself very enchanted by the way spirituality shows up in Black literature and kind of the classic Black novels. It's almost inescapable. But the difference is, there's a lot more fluidity and maybe open-handedness in Black literature than in the church pew, which is, which was trying to form me and help me to articulate exactly what I think and believe and profess particular creeds, where Toni Morrison could care less. She's not interested in telling me what to think about, what happens when I die. She's much more interested in communicating what it means to be human, a human who believes in God and doesn't believe in God. And anyways, that's a very long way to say the two kind of trains of inspiration are the same for me. So I look to people like Toni Morrison, people like James Baldwin, Alice Walker, and of course, a lot of poetry as well, I think, has kind of grounded me. People in my life, my father, of course, my grandma, but as I've gotten older, I found myself gravitating toward poets and artists and people who aren't really threatened by my belief or disbelief, and in that way, I don't feel like my belonging is at stake. I can kind of expand and think and question without so much risk.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting to me that you said, during college, you were reading what at least I think of as Black liberation literature. And then on the other hand, you were entering church spaces anew, and you're kind of holding those tensions of both together. How were they conflicting, and how were they also speaking to each other at that time?
I think they were speaking to each other in that up until that point, I thought of myself as, a very rational, I believe I thought of myself as someone who doesn't really entertain the idea of like the invisible things. And I thought belief in God, belief in the unseen felt not just not foolish, but just something that I didn't feel like I could access, or that I needed to be a particular kind of person in order to access. And I've always been a cynic. I'm working on it. A skeptic. And in that way, it felt like belief was always going to be very far from me. And I think what they shared in common was a kind of freedom to think, okay, this isn't frivolous. This isn't tangential to the human experience. This isn't like the spiritual dimension of one's life isn't just, it's inescapable. It's not something that you can pick and choose. And right. As a writer, if I'm going to write something honest, I have to, if I'm trying to write something honest about the people I come from, I have to contend with the spiritual dimension of what it means to be Black in America. It's and so I felt a compatibility there of, this is This isn't tangential. This is central to what it means to be human, and certainly a Black human coming from who I come from.
Yeah.
The difference, I would say, is the Christian space I found myself in was not only white dominated, but I think quite close-minded, and really like many, but not all Christian spaces, but certainly many of them, it demanded, I think, a certain thing or profess a certain thing in order to believe or in order to retain my belonging. And that was in stark contrast to kind of Black liberation texts who, you know, it's very invitational. Toni Morrison did not think the same thing as James Baldwin, did not think the same thing as Zora Neale Hurston. At times their words are compatible, at times they're not, you know, and there's beauty and real tension in that kind of welcome, knowing this doesn't depend on, I don't know, my belonging doesn't depend on how much belief I can muster any given morning. And, I think that's a relief, and that's a freedom I find in kind of Black texts that I don't always find in like a church pew.
Yeah. So I'm wary of using the word deconstruction, but it sounds like you did do a little bit of deconstructing your own theology in many senses.
You know, people ask me a lot about deconstruction. Okay, if I'm honest, don't ask me about it, because okay. I know very little about deconstruction, and I feel like for me, it was kind of a remembering the journey after college. And once I left that particular brand of Christianity, it was like, I thought a lot about what spirituality in my home did possess. It wasn't necessarily Christian, but what are the kind of spiritual values, like storytelling, like myth, like humor. But I didn't, I think I just led altogether. And while some people, I feel like I woke up one day and realized that everyone else took this path of deconstruction and found these authors that were guiding them. I can think of friends after college who read Shane Claiborne's book, Here's the Civil Revolution. And I feel like I just skipped it all and I fled straight to kind of the artists, the poets. And then I slowly remembered and kind of gained back what, you know, felt right and true. But the process of actively deconstructing, I always feel a bit inadequate to speak to, because I feel like there are so many other people who did it in such intentional ways.
If I had to diagnose it, I'd probably say that it's because, you know, some of us grew up in very religious families and we had to confront, you know, evangelical Christianity in our everyday life, in our everyday myth making, everyday storytelling, you know, in the overarching, you know, narratives and collective memory making that was going on in the immediacy of our lived experience, right? And maybe in a funny way, you were probably shielded from that until you voluntarily went in there as an adult seeking some sort of, you know, whatever spiritual information. And then you had the agency by this time, agency of spirit, to say, no, this doesn't work for me. Adios, you know.
Yes. You know, I do think there's something there of, I don't think it can be emphasized enough, the work that does on a child's brain to grow up and be formed in a particular kind of religious culture under a religious demand. Yeah. And I was just speaking to someone who I'm queer, and they were kind of asking about the religious trauma of that. And I was thinking, well, sure, there is some kind of like white noise level trauma from the world around me. But the reality is I didn't have to go to sleep as a child, you know, every night wondering if I was going to go to hell or not. I don't know what that does to a person. And I'm from a family that was, I could be anything, you know, I know that there was going to be embrace on the other end of like my story. And I think that shifts how you have to leave a place, because I could leave in a way and just go return to something. And so many people are leaving without anything to return to, and they're having to kind of reconstruct another way, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah. But let's go back to, you know, Black liturgy is the page. Obviously there was some kind of a spiritual journey that led to you, you know, starting Black liturgies, but also having done the work to be in a place where you could act as, you know, a curator for it?
Yes. So I had started to attend an Episcopal church after college and working for one, actually, in partnership with the Catholic University. So I was just, entrenched. And I went from still liturgy, but liturgy that's not as acknowledged in a kind of Presbyterian, a young Presbyterian church, to liturgy of in the Anglican sense and in the Catholic sense. And I found a lot of rest in it.
Yeah.
I was, at that point, my depression was just causing a lot of limitations in how I was able to exist in the world, and coming into a space where it didn't depend so much on me needing to manufacture a way to connect with God or articulate the words was very restful for me. And the Book of Common Prayer in that way was really restful and kind of a harbor. Of course, over time, you recognize all the different tensions that exist, you know, for all its beauty. The Book of Common Prayer has limitations, of course. I know what was happening to my ancestors while Thomas Cranmer wrote the Book of Common Prayer. So of course, when you come to kind of the summer of 2020, it's just going to be hard to approach that as a spiritual comfort. And I would log on to, you know, we were still on lockdown. I would log on to a Zoom service, and knowing, you know, for however much this liturgy at one point comforted me in that particular season, in the midst of so much public Black death and a kind of, I don't know, what appeared to be a reckoning with anti-Blackness globally, it was just difficult to feel like the Book of Common Prayer could speak to Black grief and Black joy and Black memory in a way that felt honest. And so I started Black liturgies out of that. So while I fled, you know, and kind of went towards the artists and the poets in my life, there was some part of me, I think, that wasn't prepared to relinquish altogether, one, this sense of connection to the divine, but also this sense of connection to to tradition and to a liturgical form of connecting with God. So when the time came, if I tell people if I was going to do anything to contribute to anything that summer, I knew it was going to be writing. The question is just what kind. And I was feeling near to God in that season.
Yeah. And you were not just writing. You were writing and curating a sort of, you know, in my opinion, a sort of liberation ready reckoner. And what I thought Black liturgies was doing, and I mean, of course, the book is a different story, but the Black liturgy, the page, what I felt it was doing was that it was providing not just, you know, it was rooted in the Black experience, but it was providing so many people from so many different marginalized communities with some sort of an emancipatory vocabulary, which they probably never had access to until then, you know. And I'm saying this specifically because, you know, I come from India, and when I was looking through, I was looking at all my friends who follow your page, and there's just so many, you know, Dalit activists and scholars who are following your page, you know. And I had about 50 friends of mine, all of whom are from India, and they were all following you. And I was just thinking about, and I've seen them, you know, share Black liturgies widely. And I was just thinking, you know, so many communities across the world just lack that kind of, you know, compilation of very important but necessary and urgent liberatory text that that they're now using in their struggles, in their specific struggles, in their specific contexts. So Black liturgies, in that sense, was kind of, you know, overarching these epistemic and spiritual inequities, so to speak, that people would otherwise have had to, confront.
Mm.
I mean, you're global, you know that, right?
Thank you for saying that. I forget the reach that kind of community has had. And I think, I don't know, when I think about, when I said, you know, I was kind of looking to still keep some of the tradition, I think in some ways that curation is honoring that piece of us that wants to trace the line, to trace the line back and realize my suffering is not unique, my joy is not unique to me, that It's a connective force, and I feel like that is it's really refreshing, and especially in a time where so many people are. I mean, we're kind of trained to be enamored with the new and the newest voice and the most, I don't know, but I think so much of anything that I say is actually old. It's old wisdom. It exists long before me. If you're resonating with it, it probably did not originate with me. It's because it can be traced back, and so to have that to give Black liberation writers and the Black literate ancestors a voice in the project. I'm probably most proud of that, of the curation, almost more than the writing. So
yeah, as you should be. Mm-hmm. I wonder which came first, the chicken or the egg, because did you decide to use a liturgical framework for the book because you already had the name Liturgies in your social media page? Is that how it began?
Yes, I would say so. A few weeks after I started the page, I started to get DMs from people saying, can you assemble this into a book, or can you put this into a PDF? And I just didn't really have imagination for it at that point. I say that the community did before, much earlier than I did. And then, 2 years later, I released This Here Flesh, which is absolutely not the book that they were asking me to write. And still they accepted it with such care and with such advocacy. And it's why the book This Here Flesh did well. I'm keenly aware of that. But it's because of that particular community, and not everyone's digital communities translate to book sales. And so I felt this responsibility. I'm like, they've been waiting. I want to honor what I've been doing with that space and kind of give them this physical artifact, but I don't want it to feel, I want it to feel familiar, but not boring. So I came up with this format that I think is reminiscent of the digital project, of course, but it's not an exact mirror, but hopefully anyone that's familiar with that project will find themselves on some level on the page.
Right. But the liturgical format, I mean, I find that you kind of employed it in a very subversive way, because you have your own stories, which is great because you're kind of centering the Black story, right? You have poetry, you have embodied, breathing exercises, you have reflections, you have your favorite, poetry and then you also have kind of the benediction and all of that. So talk to me a little about how you came up with that process.
Mm-hmm. I wanted something that felt, I wanted everything.
Yeah.
I wanted it all. I still don't quite know how I convinced my editor to let me have it all. But I think there are so many different ways, there's so many different paths and to connect with God. And for some people that's, and depending on the day it changes, but for some people that's poetry and the imprecision and the kind of imagery of the poem. And for some people that's, interior examining kind of the questions for contemplation. And I just wanted all of it, all of these different kind of paths or maybe rooms that people could enter and exit as they wanted or as it felt safe for them.
Yeah.
I say, I don't think there are parts of it, that aren't going to feel right to certain people or, depending on what religious trauma you have, even there are parts that you may want to avoid, but be able to enter and exit different rooms and kind of know what they each stand for. But I also had an imagination for, okay, could this be used? Could this actually be pieced together in a way that could create a communal gathering, that felt coherent? And so of course I drew inspiration from kind of Christian liturgy throughout time, where there's some element of truth telling, there's some element of kind of, in the Episcopal churches, you say the prayers of the people, where you kind of get into the interior life, the world around you, the justice on a global scale, a local scale. So anyways, I wanted it to feel as if it could be taken out of the book and practiced into community if you assembled a lot of different components. words.
Right. Although I felt, so for all of you who haven't read the book, the first portion is divided up under the category of stories, and then the second portion is categorized by time. So, you know, you have liturgies for different times of the day, different times, different important days like Kwanzaa and Mother's Day and things like that. So it's a very diverse book, and yet it kind of packs in very compactly a sort of liturgical tradition that is rooted entirely and unapologetically in Black experience. Would that be a safe summary, Cole?
Yeah, I love that summary. I'll take that. Okay. That on the book.
Yeah, and I think what really spoke to me more than anything else is that you kind of opened up the space in the room for anger.
Mm.
There was, you know, in a lot of liturgy, you're just like, oh, please God, forgive me. But here you're like, no, you need to come here with reparations. You need to come here with reconciliation, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of room for not just people being forgiven, but also people holding, you're also holding space for people to forgive, for Black people and the Black soul to forgive, which I mean for me at least that was really moving. But I'd love to read it's just one of my favorite passages from your book in the chapter Dignity. It says, for those who dare degrade, God who keeps watch, woe to those who dare degrade us. May we see them for what they are and call wicked by its name. Awaken in us a sacred intuition that exposes those who work exhaustively against our welfare. We're tired of protecting them. We're tired of easing them into the realization of their own violence, the ugly that has made its home in them. May they writhe in the night. May their inner worlds tremble. May this make the secret guilt that drives them grow loud enough to shame them. Let the sound reach those who need protection. And may we have the wisdom to trust our instincts, believing ourselves when a space or moment doesn't feel safe, even if we cannot articulate why. God, keep watch, keep guard as we wait for the day when the terrible become human again. May it be so. Wow. There's just so much power and beauty in just kind of holding space for that kind of anger and that kind of rage.
Thank you, which I think
is just denied so much for Black people and marginalized mm-hmm. people.
Yeah, absolutely. I in this here flesh, there's there's a chapter on rage in that book, and it's the only chapter in the book that required a massive rewrite. Oh, really? Oh my God, my notes back from my editors, the only one list of, and it's because I had written, you know, an entire chapter on rage without feeling any, and I had sanitized it. And I'm really grateful that I was they drew me into something different and helped me tap into something different. So, but when I went to write this rage section, I was very aware of, okay, the last time you tried to write anger, you cleaned it up, you made it tidy, you divorced yourself from it, which I don't do with other components of, you know, emotion in writing. And so I really challenged myself. And, you know, anytime I would feel guilt, I would have Audre Lorde's words from The Uses of Anger in my head. I would, also the imprecatory psalms. I said, oh, if the psalmist did it, you know, why can't I? And I feel proud of that. I feel that part of the work of trying to translate, or the arrogance even of speaking to a collective Black interior world, is to try to complicate it, is to try to say we are more than one thing, and divorcing ourselves from any one emotion does not serve anyone but the people who have everything to gain from our numbness. You know, people who have systems that have that stand to benefit from us being emotionally repressed, emotionally disconnected, from me being complacent and apathetic. And to do this book justice, I knew I needed to challenge that one dimensionality. And that includes, I mean, a robust emotional life includes rage. It just does.
Yeah. And I also love that, you know, you call upon the multiplicities of human emotion, but also you call upon the multiplicities of the human experience. You're you're speaking to, you know, aging people, you're speaking to the experience of aging people, you're speaking to the experience of disabled people, of children, of the little Black girl, you know, you're speaking to all those different experiences. And correspondingly, you're also attributing those various multiplicities to the idea of the divine, of God. Like, you know, you're saying queer God or near God, or, you know, what was going on in your mind as you were kind of, you know, kind of dabbling in all those, in the multitudes, so to speak?
Yeah. You know, I think as I was writing, I don't remember thinking much about the naming of God. But after, like, since I've written it, it's almost been like a revelation in hindsight of what was happening in me. And I think I really was kind of desperate for freedom to have God look like a multitude, for the divine to take on many different components, or at least to practice imagination for that. Even if I don't know for certain, you know, can I practice imagination for queer God? Can I practice imagination for divine mirror, whatever that means? And to just add a little more curiosity, I think that's what is happening when you're naming God. You're not, you know, it's not prescriptive. It's a dreaming. It's a wondering, and almost in a kind of childlike way of, you know, who are you? Who am I approaching right now? And could you be like this? Could you be like a mirror? Could you be like a labyrinth at times? And
you're also challenging and reclaiming.
Yeah, yeah. And I think in hindsight, I was looking for that. I mean, it's hard. It sounds weird because I write spiritual books, but it's a struggle for me because I contain so much doubt. Doubt and probably more doubt than certainty. And I think in some ways that naming and that multitude of naming, that multiplicity in it, it makes room for the doubts. It makes room for the uncertainty because it's not trying to narrow in on any one presentation of what God looks like or what God appears like to me.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, you know, for me, it was revolutionary because I remember when I read This Your Flesh, I remember calling up one of my friends and I said, hey, I actually found a book where the Christian God is not referred to as a male. And for me, that was like, oh my goodness, that was just groundbreaking for me. And then in Black liturgies, it's like, you know, you've just sort of gone all out, you know, just sort of naming and claiming and reclaiming the various multiplicities of God, sort of saying, hey, I kind of reject, you know, this patriarchal heteronormative version of God that everyone's trying to push on us. I want to acknowledge that God is so much bigger than all of that. Mm-hmm. There's just so much beauty in that. That reminds me, what about, you know, you use Ashe a lot over Amen. What about that? Talk to us about that.
That is straight from the digital project, Black Liturgies. I was introduced to that term through followers, and people would comment it, and they still do. Like after in my posts, there's specifically about 5 people who comment it consistently. And so they drew me into that language, and it's kind of a nod to them and kind of a nod to the remaking and the reclaiming that you said, that even they expanded my imagination for how to close a prayer up until, I mean, on Black Liturgies, the digital pages, I usually don't even end the prayer. I kind of I don't say Amen. I don't say Ashe. I don't say May it be so. I just kind of let it be and let people, with the hope that people are ending it in a way that feels true to them. But in the book format, I'm like, I need closes. I need closure. Right. Right. I didn't want to give it, but I'm like, I need it. So I wanted to kind of give some different options. So some say Amen, some say Ashe, some say May it be so. And yeah, hopefully that kind of makes it, I don't know, a little bit easier to approach for different people.
Yeah, yeah. No, it felt moving and beautiful and profound. Mm-hmm. What I also really loved about the liturgies is that, you know, a lot of spiritual books kind of tend to abstract spirituality, whereas you kind of center the focus on the Black body. And it just kind of reminded me so much about, you know, Kimberly Crenshaw's insistence that when you're thinking of the Black body and the Black experience, you need to think about it from all different strands of oppression that could land as violence on the body. And you know, it's just, I feel like there was so much of a pulling in of, you know, the visceral and the raw aspects of just embodying prayer, embodying reflection, but also embodying pain and sorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, thank you for saying that. I want people to feel that, certainly. I think, I don't know, a lot of us know what it means to belong to Christian spaces or religious spaces that kind of ask us to sacrifice our bodies or have demanded that a lot more than they've asked us to, you know, rest, to care for ourselves, to pay attention. I think many of us have been taught that the body can't be trusted, that it's deceitful even, or I think there's a counter narrative that actually the body carries a lot of wisdom, a lot of deep intuition. And I hope that when people encounter my work, they feel like they're meeting it in their bodies, not just as a mind divorced from the rest of them. That's costed me greatly, that kind of divorce, and I don't want to perpetuate it in the world.
Right. And it's beautiful because you also, while you talk about, you know, pain or anger and all of those things, you're also adding the embodied practice of, you know, breathing exercises, inhaling and exhaling, you know, good and the bad. What was your, what led you to that beauty?
Of breath practice specifically?
Yeah. And including that in liturgies.
Well, it's a very practical answer. And in that, I had started to write little breath prayers for myself after I started Black Liturgy, sharing Black Liturgies on Instagram. And I would, throughout the day, do a breath practice for myself, just to remind myself that there were real people on the other end of the words, encountering the words throughout the day, not in the same time as I was. And so it was just a kind of way to tether me to them. And I had told someone, and they were like, why don't you just share those? Why aren't you? Right. And yes, I owe that person a lot, because I was telling people to be in their bodies and stay in their bodies in an extremely disembodied platform that benefits from our kind of disconnection and our disembodiment.
Right.
And so I started to slowly incorporate the breath practice. And over time, it's felt almost more honest to me than the actual written prayers. In that they're a little easier for me to approach. I don't have to have so much language put to them, but I can kind of connect this, my interior world, with this physical rhythm in me. And I need that. I mean, especially in times like this, when, you know, with everything happening in the world, and I mean, in Gaza, the West Bank, Congo, Sudan, I'm out of words. You know, I don't have much left to say. And so, what does prayer look like out of that void? And I think the answer can look like in the body, that there is real wisdom, and the body can be a real portal to connection with God apart from articulation. You know,
right, and that kind of takes me to, you know, You've never shied away from centering the story, when so much of a lot of spiritual literature can just go on pontificating without really centering the story. And you sort of center the story, you sort of center community. In fact, can I read my favorite passage from your book, the one that I've
got? Yes, please. I love hearing you read.
Okay. So this is like, I've come back to this a lot of times. This one is called For the Kitchen. God of the kitchen table, we are grateful for the mysteries of our mother's kitchen, our grandmother's frying pan, our father's spices. May our kitchens belong to a legacy of resistance and reclamation. In a world where we have not always been granted agency, may we choose an experiment. Under a patriarchy that does not trust Black women, may we trust ourselves, eyeing every seasoning, feeling the recipe, not as command, but as soul. Remind us that this is a site of innovation, at times making miracles of what little we've had, our hands multiplying food in divine mystery. Protect the kitchen conversations, the laughter, the community organizing, the remembrance that are so often practiced at the table or counters as we wait for food that will remind us of what we're worthy of. And as we think back on all that has formed us throughout time, may we remember that what happens here is sacred, that we've made a space for us. May we eat and be filled. Ashri. I could write an anthropological thesis on this. on community, on, you know, on collective memory, on, you know, you wrote about how you were looking through your grandmother's things and there was just like not that much of material memory. But, you know, I think about, you know, black families and how maybe food was their index for memory, you know, and culture mm-hmm. and togetherness and community. I love that passage. I go back to it all the time. Talk to me more about it.
Yeah. I like the idea of very specific moments or things that have been viewed as mundane actually being expansive and containing a whole lot. And I think the kitchen table is one example of that. It's not maybe the best. There's more mundane things, but there's so much that happens, you know, at that site. And I think that can be translated to a lot of different mundane activities to realize throughout our days, we are making a way. We're ultimately making a way to survive, to honor each other, to remember, to connect. And there's so much beauty in that waiting to be held, waiting to have someone witness it, you know. And we have these moments where we witness it in fragments, where maybe you look up from the table and you have that moment where you realize, oh, this is going to stay with me. And I love that feeling that, you know, if you are, I don't know if you've ever had that where you're like living a moment and simultaneously, you know, like this is simple, but I'm going to remember this. Yeah. I think I want that moment in some of my writing and certainly in some of my prayers of like there are elements of what it means to be human that maybe people don't immediately see as a thesis, but actually there's so much meat there. There's so much to it of what's happening. And yeah, I love that you read that.
It's also like, you know, you're dignifying mundanity, mm-hmm. you know, there's like a dignity, like many people will be like, oh, we're just eating at a you know, at a counter. But here you're saying, no, this is sacred communion. This, what's happening here is beautiful. What's happening here is holy. I think I go back a lot to it because I'm not a food person, but I've begun to realize that, you know, I moved from India to America like 2 years ago. And I've realized that some of the ways in which I can hold on to a memory, because, you know, I can't carry material memory all the way here. But one of the ways in which I can preserve the kind of legacy I've received is through food, or is through what food, you know, accomplishes, which is, you know, community, bringing people together, bringing memories together. It's definitely one of my favorite passages. But we're kind of coming to a close here. If anyone has absolutely any questions for Cole, please, you can just type them out here. And I'm just going to really quickly check if we have any questions out on other channels. Okay, well, any questions for Cole? Hi, Shane.
This has been so great. I'm not cutting you off. Keep going if you want, Divya. I'm sure we'll, we should at least make sure folks know how to follow you, Cole, and stay in touch.
Yes, sure. You can go to my website, colearthurriley.com. And if you're interested in Black Liturgies, that's at Black Liturgies on Instagram and on Facebook. Yeah.
So good. Divya, anything else that you...
No, I was going to ask Cole, before we wrap up, is there anything else that, you know, I feel like I could go on chatting forever, but is there anything else that you'd like to, you know, say or add about both the book and also, you know, the work that you want to do about the current violence that you've been speaking so much to? Anything really?
Nothing in particular comes to mind. I guess just an affirmation of you, really. I had a few questions that I was going to ask you, but I'm like, maybe it's not the time. But I'm grateful for the intention with which you asked questions and the community that you all are fostering here. I just think is just wild. And watching the care and compassion behind the scenes, I think is beautiful. So I'm always grateful to be in spaces that feel healthy and safe. And this is one of them. So thanks for the work that you all are doing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's our honor. Oh, Marianne, who...
Yeah, that was a great question.
By the way, she contributes a lot to our wake up. So thank you, Marianne. So nice to see you, virtually. Marianne asks, I love how Cole has written about humor as part of the divine experience. Could you speak more to that?
Yeah. I think that's the first time anyone's ever asked me that, because I'm not funny. I'm not a funny person. And people think that's self-deprecating. It's just the reality of my situation. But I've come from a very, very funny family, like makes your side hurt when you leave them, kind of funny. And I think I've learned a way of being that's just so serious. And it leaves life lacking, I think, when we're only concerned with the serious and the grave. And I think there's a kind of levity that maybe won't like save us from despair, but I definitely think it's like a minor antidote in some ways, like not the full antidote, but it keeps you from completely being lost in despair if you're able to possess some level of levity, some level of humor. There's I'll forget the quote exactly, but you know, there's a beautiful quote about like laughing and singing along the way. Like, life's a hard battle anyways, you know, why not? And so in time, well, I'll say originally I learned a spirituality that was as serious and dull and grave as I am. And I think as I've kind of reclaimed some of my childhood self, I've tapped in more to the mischief, to the funny, even if it doesn't originate with me. I think humor when practiced well is a really beautiful disarming force in community.
Yeah. So good. Well, I was thinking how much you talk about curiosity and all of there's like such a beautiful sort of exploration of spirituality. A lot of folks were affirming that. And I was thinking about, you know, with Jamar Tisby, and someone said, Christians are people who don't have any questions, who only have answers and certainty. And that's part of the problem, right? Is we're talking about a God that's way beyond our head. And you capture that with all the beautiful, curious, poetic, artful ways. So may we not be people who don't have any questions or doubts. And I think you invite us into that. So thanks so much. Is there anything else, Cole, Divya? I'm going to close this with a prayer from Black Liturgies, but anything else, Divya?
No, I'm good. Thank
Cole,
you.
Thank you. What a great hour, Rich.
Thank you.
And, you know, just like we keep our joy alive, we protect our joy. And yet I didn't mention that there are two executions planned tomorrow. One of them in Texas, where half of our executions are, and the other one I think is Idaho, where there hasn't been an execution in over 10 years. So we, you know, we will be holding vigils with death penalty action around those tomorrow, but we'll also be singing. We will be resilient in our presence. You know, this hour has been such a gift, and we try to thank everybody that contributes. So we'll give Cole a gift from Red Letter Christians, and we never want you to feel like you have to give money to come participate in conversations like this. But if you have some that you can share, it keeps everything going and allows us to show some love to wonderful people like Cole. So if you can give, you can go to redletterchristians.org. And if you can't give money, then find other ways to contribute and be a part of this little movement. And let me send this out. It, you know, for folks that aren't from, you know, familiar with liturgy, this season before Easter is Lent. And this is from the Lent section. It's a beautiful prayer, I think, in light of all the death that's pressing in, but also the joy, the hope. And this is a prayer from the Lent section of Black Liturgies. God of solidarity, thank you for being a God who enters the suffering of the world, who doesn't run from those in pain, but rushes to the sight of blood, of tears. Release us from empty cravings of unity that come at no cost to the oppressor, and guide us toward a solidarity that demands something of us. Let us learn to risk ourselves on behalf of the vulnerable, believing that when one of us is harmed, we all are. Help us to remember that justice and liberation are not a scarcity, and that our survival and dignity are wrapped up in one another. And God, keep us from those who will demonize the fight in us, who would prefer us complacent and far from one another. Secure in us the courage to stand, knowing together we will restore what the world has tried to suffocate in us. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Red Letter Christians podcast. Too often, Christians have used our faith as a ticket into heaven and a license to ignore the world we live in. But at Red Letter Christians, we believe our faith is not just about going to heaven when we die, but also about bringing heaven to earth while we live. For more information on Red Letter Christians and upcoming events, additional resources, you can go to the show notes or our website, redletterchristians.org. You can also support Red Letter Christians by giving a one-time donation or becoming a monthly sustainer. Just go to our website and click the red donate button. Thank you for being a part of this conversation and for being a part of this movement.